Hello, board members. How are you? Sorry I can't see all of you today, but it's good to be back. I'm Stephen Moore, Vice Chair of the State Water Board and liaison to the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board, among others. I just visited your colleagues in San Francisco Bay Region last month, and I'll be going to the Santa Ana Region tomorrow. But today, I thought I'd just share some things going on. I haven't met with you since April, and because of different scheduling conflicts and that sort of thing. And as you know, I usually organize my remarks by budget, recent activities of the State Board that may be of interest, upcoming activities that may be of interest, and then any interesting legislation going on that we're tracking. And that's the season we're in, so I'll spend a little time on that right at the end of my remarks. Not a lot to say about budget. You know, the 18-19 budget was passed in June, and as expected, we didn't really get augmentations this time around. Over the years, you know, we've been pretty successful last 4 or 5 years in getting budget augmentations for staff and resources. This year, most state agencies were denied their budget requests, however they may have been warranted. There have been some exceptions. Prop 68 passed, which was the Parks, Wildlife, and Water bond, and so there will be some Division of Financial Assistance staff supported by that measure. Recently, we adopted statewide water quality objectives for bacteria. That was last month. It's a culmination of a couple of years of work, and the upshot is that we brought in the US EPA recommended standards based on Enterococcus in saltwater and E. coli in freshwater. And so we have now a consistent system statewide. We retained fecal coliform objectives in ocean waters because of some scientific studies we've helped fund that show some relationship epidemiologically between that indicator and some sickness that in users of ocean water. So that'll be an ongoing area of study of refinement. On bacteria, we also took advantage of some innovation by regional boards because, as you know, bacteria is a indicator measurement and has, you know, confounding factors that may lead to false positives and that sort of thing. It's not a direct measurement of pathogenic risk. So given that, there have been some innovations in other regional boards about excluding natural sources of bacteria with relation to real public health threat. And number two, wet weather suspension of objectives when no one in their right mind should be in that water anyway during really high flows. So, you know, therefore, you know, common sense says we don't have to have a strict adherence to numeric bacterial indicators at those times. That isn't an automatic. This is something that you will have the discretion to use these tools, and this statewide objective action empowers regional boards to have that flexibility moving forward. Some examples. Also, there was a generic adoption in that package of water quality variances of water quality standards. This is a mechanism that's in Federal Clean Water Act, but it requires a state to adopt that into their plan of water quality standards. So this variance tool is now available for all water quality objectives in all basin plans, not just bacteria. And there's current federal guidance that we base that on. So it's just another tool in the toolbox for your consideration moving forward. Upcoming, our next board meeting, we're going to discuss fees. We're a fee-based organization, the state and regional water boards. And this year, the proposals hold a couple of programs steady with no fee increases. That's the MPDS Stormwater and the land disposal programs. But the other programs, we now have 8 program areas, thanks to cannabis. We used to have 7 general program areas. So in all these areas, whether it's confined animal facilities, ag lands, MPDS wastewater and that sort of thing, all have proposed fee increases. And this is based on an assessment of program staff needs around the state and the current budget. And we have been strategically drawing down some reserves to help keep fee increases steady in the last couple of years. But we hope to have a system where we don't revisit every program every year, but have, you know, a built-in steady increase based on cost of living, and so folks can budget accordingly in our regulated community. So that's the ideal, so that we're not having these discrete stepwise jumps, which create kind of an abrupt change to folks' budget cycles. So we're still working on getting to that, but I think we're not ping-ponging around as much as we used to. And same for the drinking water program, that's being held steady as well. So there'll be more discussion about that at our upcoming board meeting. Other upcoming items I just want to flag for your attention for staff and board members. We're working at the statewide level on the sanitary sewer overflow waste discharge requirements. It's a general order that was adopted in 2006. And as your sanitary engineer representative on the State Water Board, that's my official position, I really have been paying attention to this program area in terms of public health protection and asset management of our collection systems around the state, and paying attention to underground infrastructure that can be forgotten and maintenance put off because it's out of sight, out of mind, in terms of local expenditures. So there's a potential unraveling that can occur in our infrastructure because it's out of sight, out of mind, unlike parks, schools, some public safety issues. So I consider this a really great success as far as a program now that's in its 12th year. And if you go back in 2007-2008 timeframe, our tally of reported sanitary sewer overflows was about 6,000 statewide in that year. And then fast forward to 11, 12 years later, instead of 6,000, back in 16-17, which is a really wet year where you have more overflows, we only had 3,700. So it was almost cut in half. And then this year, below 3,000. So less than half of the reported spills of 10 years ago. And so that's just one indicator of a successful program where we've worked cooperatively with local collection system managers to figure out a good way to systematically set up asset management, create those incentives within our waste discharge requirements. So I think this has been a real successful program. It's changed the culture of our wastewater agencies. Not just us and our action, but their actions as well as responsible stewards of the infrastructure. And so now we're really looking at updating the order. Some innovations we're going to try to implement including larger private systems and laterals, serving places like mobile home parks, homeowner-associated systems, industrial parks, educational institutions, shopping centers, those kind of bigger, you know, adjunct collection systems, looking for how we can address climate change and give folks credit for their efforts to do that, and then consider cost of compliance through removal or reduction of requirements that no longer are providing valuable information from the program that was envisioned in 2006. I think that's a good program to track and continue to pay attention to because it really engages our local government partners in responsible management and, you know, capital improvement and systematic asset management of collection systems. And I think the stormwater side of our local government can really learn from those lessons learned on the wastewater collection systems on asset management. And I want to encourage you to encourage them to look at things in that methodical way. I know you all are actively participating in the Lower Klamath project, the dam removals. And just, you know, a quick overview. On June 7th, we issued a draft water quality certification to the Klamath River Renewal Corporation's project to remove the four dams, three in California, and Oregon Department of Environmental Quality concurrently issued their water quality certification for the J.C. Boyle Dam around that time. And in the we received about 42 comment letters on that draft certification. They're all on our website posted. The comments were due at the end of July. And in the interim, we've been meeting with the tribes that have a great interest in this overall project. Tribal consultation included meetings with the Shasta Indian Nation, the Yurok Tribe, the Hoopaw Valley Tribe, and the Karuk Tribe. And then also in August, staff met with the Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors. We're also participating, as you are, in the Interim Measures Implementation Committee. That's KRRC is continuing to participate in, and there's a priority list of projects for the $5.4 million that are available for water quality projects, and the diffuse source treatment wetlands, riparian fencing, and grazing management, irrigation efficiency and water management, and natural wetland restoration are all priorities in that process. We've been very busy grappling with the Bay Delta issues. Two of the five state board members are hearing officers on the proposed California Water Fix project to change the point of diversion for the state and federal water projects, and then there's a water rights proceeding. We are over 100 full days of hearings done so far, starting in the middle of 2016. We just completed the rebuttal phase of the part two part of the hearing, which considered whether the change in point of diversion would cause an unreasonable effect on fish and wildlife. Part one was, will the change in point of diversion have will cause harm to downstream water rights holders? So those are the two parts of the hearing. Now the rebuttal phase has come to conclusion, and there's still some outstanding what we call sur rebuttal, which is rebuttal to the rebuttal, I think. I'm not a lawyer. So that's ongoing, but we are at a recess now so that board member Tam Doda can have her September vacation that she always plans. So I'm very happy that she was able to get that in. We also had a major hearing, 2 days, 150 public speakers on the proposal to amend the water quality control plan for the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta, or the Bay Delta Plan, to establish flow water quality objectives for the lower San Joaquin River and its tributaries to support fish and wildlife beneficial uses. Also, salinity objectives for the South Delta. And I encourage you to, even though it's not part of your region, to monitor those discussions, because at the heart of the proposal is to look at river health needs for fish and wildlife, but also there's public health issues. As you all know, your staff work on the issue of harmful algal blooms and how excessive diversion can lead to high water residence time that naturally selects for cyanobacteria growth over more beneficial green algae growth. And so, what we are contemplating is the prospect of a budget of water that not only, so that your budget not only looks at human uses, agricultural, urban, groundwater recharge, right, because of the SGMA issues, many overdrafted groundwater basins in the area, but some are not. It's a mixed bag out there. But looking ahead, the need to budget water for environmental purposes as well as human uses. So it's a percent of the unimpaired flow approach, and it's something that takes into account an overall budget framework. It's very controversial because if you then overlay what we've developed, we are taking more for human uses in many of our watersheds than the science suggests is necessary to support fish and wildlife uses in concurrence. So it's very controversial because of all of the developed infrastructure we have and the need to have a soft landing approach so that we don't have abrupt changes that cause economic distress. And so it's a very tough balancing act, but it's part of what we have to do. And we delayed adoption of that proposal to encourage more discussion about voluntary settlements, but I'll point out to folks that in the program of implementation that we are considering, we really carve out a place for voluntary settlements after board adoption of the proposal. And so I'm encouraging folks to look at the language there to make sure that they see the possibility of coming up with not just a flow-based approach, but have habitat, predation control, all of the potpourri of things that are needed for sustainable fish and wildlife. So keep an eye on that, you know, in terms of the voluntary settlement provisions that can be, it's a lot like, it's a very common thing we do at the water boards, is this idea of alternative compliance. That is, there is a, you know, a standard that we want to achieve, but there's more than one way to get to that end point. And so that's really what I see with the voluntary settlement agreement approach, which you may end up thinking about in some of the implementation at your programs, TMDL and otherwise, is having a place for people to come together with an alternative commitment that meets the intent and provides an equivalent level of protection to what you are contemplating in a strict water quality or water quantity based regulatory approach. So it's an important discussion, and I think at the heart of that is the idea that we can't anticipate all the ways people, the method and manner by which we can achieve the multiple, you know, human uses and fish and wildlife uses. And we want to create space in our programs for creativity, innovation, and partnership. And that's really at the heart of this approach we're trying to implement in the lower San Joaquin River. Shifting gears, I just always like to look at our monthly report on Division of Financial Assistance and point out places where we've spent money in your region, you know, so that you know that we're paying attention. It's not all going to LA or, you know, that kind of thing. And the Office of Sustainable Water Solutions was formed in our DFA to try to come up with water wastewater solutions for small communities, disadvantaged communities around the state. And, you know, the folks in the Central Valley gather a lot of the press, you know, with the Tulare County problems, or, you know, even Salinas Valley. But we're really trying to be statewide in this. And one of we did just grant $500,000 to the Toloa Dene Nation in Smith River, coincidentally, for the wastewater system improvement planning study. So this is $500,000, not just to do infrastructure, but to plan that infrastructure, which is a sorely needed source of funding in disadvantaged communities around the state. You know, everybody wants to fund the capital improvements, but there's planning that must go in ahead of time, and it's harder to get those funds. So we were trying to direct the Prop 1 funds, and then if Prop 3 passes, there will be provisions for that sort of planning assistance for disadvantaged communities throughout the state. All right. Another interesting story here in the North Coast. Are you familiar with the North Coast in-stream flow policy? Anyway. Yeah. It was effective in 2014. And it precludes the acceptance of water right applications for on-stream dams on a Class 1 stream. A Class 1 stream are those where fish are always or seasonally present, either currently or historically, and habitat to sustain the fish exists. That's the Class 1. Those are the ones where there's a prohibition to put new on-stream dams in the North Coast project area. I don't know if it's the whole region. I know there's not a direct overlap, but there's a big part of the region is covered by this policy. Well, there was a proposal to do this on Humboldt Creek, by the Humboldt Resort Improvement District Number 1. And the policy does provide, we talked about alternative compliance, you know, that there can be a case-by-case exception granted. So we received a formal request for a case-by-case exception, and we can grant these when we determine the exception will not compromise maintenance of in-stream flows in the policy area, number one, And number two, the public interest will be served. So we shared this request with our partners at the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and they provided comments recommending that we deny the request and reject the application because of the potential adverse effects of the proposed on-stream dam. And so our executive director denied the exception request in July, and this is the first case-by-case exception request acted upon by the state board since the policy went into effect 4 years ago. So a little story. Coming up, you all are aware, I think, but we have the Water Quality Coordinating Committee, and that's on Tuesday, October 24th, Wednesday, October 25th. Correct me if I got those dates wrong, but it's the Tuesday, Wednesday. Okay, the 24th and the 25th. And on the 24th, oh, it's the 23rd. See, I always mess that up. So it's the 23rd and 24th, but it's the Tuesday, Wednesday. On day one, we meet with the governor's office folks and Cal EPA and our legislative staff. And then in the afternoon, we're going to discuss a couple of emerging programs. The first is the issue of homelessness and water quality. And what are the roles of the regional water boards and the state water board? And here in this region, you have your stories in the Russian River that are very interesting and important. And around the state, we have other interesting, important stories to share. We're going to have the mayor of San Diego with us. We're going to have elected official Nancy Skinner from the Bay Area. And then we're going to have the science point person on this, Ken Schiff from the SCORP science group. I'm not going to tell you what SCORP means, but I think you know what I'm talking about. That'll be an important panel, and we're leaving a lot of time for board members to have discussion and dialogue about the issue and share their experiences. And the next issue is the cannabis program, which I mentioned we have now 8 major programs in the state, and cannabis is that 8th new program. And at the one-year anniversary of the state water board's general order and policy adoption, we're going to be discussing how that program's going. We're going to have the multi-agency representatives join us, as it is a multi-agency effort. On day two, we're going to talk about climate change mitigation and adaptation efforts at each of the regional boards, and we're asking each chair and EO to pull together 15 minutes of discussion points, and it can be region-wide issues, it can be, you know, policy at the regional board, it can be projects, you know, it can be specific case studies if you want to talk about that. And this is so the 9 regional boards and the state board can share where we're at on that issue. And it's interesting because in our executive director's report, we have flagged an effort that out of the climate change resolution where we're our NPDES folks are looking at standardizing language based on regional board examples for adapting to climate change in our NPDES programs and looking at stormwater management plans, sanitary sewer management plans, I mentioned that, collection system issues, and dealing with the Administrative Procedures Manual. So there's an ongoing effort to really address climate change in our NPDES permits, but then recognizing how we might, you know, do in WDRs, maybe in timber harvest plans. You may have some ideas on how we address that. And then I know I'm taking a lot of time, but hey, I haven't seen you in a while, right? And the legislative, right now in the legislative process, there are a lot of water-related bills that have gone to the governor, but the governor hasn't signed any yet. So it's an interesting time right now. The legislative session concluded at the end of August. And looking ahead, there's I'll flag a few of these. One is SB 901 by Senator Dodd on wildfires. It would enact a number of measures to address forest fire prevention and control. It would expand the forest fire prevention pilot project exemption to allow construction or reconstruction of temporary roads under specified conditions, and would establish a new small timberland owner exemption that would allow the cutting or removal of trees on property of no more than 100 acres within a single planting watershed to reduce fire risk. So there's a limit to 100 acres in that watershed, but it does create some exemptions that I'm sure your staff will want to be tracking closely if this is signed by the governor. SB 966 gets us into the business potentially of managing on-site treated non-potable water systems. Are you familiar with some of the San Francisco examples? You know, right now they have adopted ordinances that allow for black water recycling within skyscrapers. And there are some to use for flushing, toilet flushing, and that sort of thing. So it's a way to create more localized reuse capability, lowering the demand on potable water, and in many areas of the state, lowering demand on imported water, you know, ultimately. So it's one of those local self-reliance issues. But of course, our drinking water division is concerned about these type of systems being adequately maintained and having a good oversight system local government-wise. This may work in San Francisco. It may not work in every location. And so Senator Weiner, who comes from San Francisco, is trying to structure this and come up with a program for the State Water Board to be involved in risk-based standards. So that's an ongoing issue. We've weighed in on the legislation, and we can live with what's being proposed. A couple things that affect regional boards. SB 1133 for water quality control plans, basin plans. It would allow the State Water Board to accept donations of money from a permittee on behalf of itself or a regional board for purposes of updating a basin plan. In the Bay Area, we've worked with the Association of Bay Area Governments, you know, to come up with contracting approaches to do staff support. You've probably dabbled in this a bit in terms of having discharger-funded positions. This makes it a little bit more explicit that for the basin planning function that we're always underfunded on, this is a potential pathway for getting work done. SB 1215 is a provision of sewer service to disadvantaged communities. This one, we should keep an eye on. It might help solve some problems. You know, it might be an authority for regional boards that'll be helpful. The bill would authorize regional water boards to order a city, county, or special district to provide sewer service to a disadvantaged community if that community is served by one or more inadequate on-site sewage treatment systems. And it would include stepwise approach. First, you would encourage voluntary annexation or extension of service to the disadvantaged community prior to ordering the extension of service. It would require you to have a public meeting. It would consult with land use authority and the local agency formation commission within the jurisdiction of the area prior to ordering extension of service. And it would require us at the State Water Board to make funds available for the costs of the provision of the sewer service. So this is a bit of a game changer, I guess. You know, it's a groundbreaking approach. We've used something similar in drinking water with our mandatory consolidations to deal with disadvantaged communities that are surrounded by people who have safe drinking water. This takes it into the sewer arena and would give regional water boards a frontline role in that. Sensitive but important issue. So I think I've taken much more of your time than I should, but I always want to make sure that you feel like you're in the loop on all that's going on, and it's always a pleasure to be here and learn about what's happening at the North Coast Board. Thank you.
Steve, thank you.
Questions, Mr. Corbett?
Yes, I wanted to thank you for bringing the forestry bill to our attention.
Can you turn your microphone on?
It's not on?
Gotta hit the button, John.
There it is. Is this better? Thank you for helping me with my microphone. I hope that's not a sign of the day that's coming. But I wanted to thank you for bringing the forestry bill. And I am almost embarrassed to say this because it's an admission of age. But for almost 42 years, I've been watching California struggle with fire and forest. And it tends to be going one side of really overregulation, not allowing clearing and all the other things, to the other side that will just clear cut it and take care of the problem. And neither one works, but it tends to, both sides tend to be emotional when the other one's not recent. But I think it's an area where great attention needs to happen. And I do think we're going to need some changes in the rules, but those changes will affect both sides of the aisle. And I think everyone loves their side of the aisle. And so I do want to red flag that, and I'll work with staff on some ideas, and hopefully we'll put something in my climate change comments as well, trying to deal with that issue. But I do want to caution, we tend to be all in or all out, and it's really, we require balanced forestry approaches. And one of the problems that we have is roads are regulated for non-fire circumstances, and the cost of regulating to deal with the increased erosion and environmental stresses from fires is probably prohibitively expensive. So you've approved a road, you've approved a plan, you have a fire, someone wants to go in and log, all that makes sense, but we may have to have upgrades of the road beyond forest practice rules. And I just say that I had inherited some property and we made sure we were exactly CAL FIRE rules. And they had a fire, and it made me realize that there's a different set of rules for fires. So anyway, it's a complex subject. I have the wisdom to know it's a complex subject. I have less wisdom on the solutions, but I'll look forward to working with you and staff on it. And I do want to say, we want to be very careful what's exempted. And many times the small ranch owners on the road issue are extremely vulnerable on the erosion side of the aisle. And so many of the ways we've tried to make forest practices more livable by having some of the smaller non-industrial timber have long-range plans may work less well if we have a lot of fires. So and that alone is a very sensitive subject. So I think we got a good, healthy 10 years ahead of us on trying to work it out. But I do want to say it's not simple, and there are problems. And you don't want to spend 99 years regulating a watershed to have it pristine, have a fire, overreact to the fire, and have the whole thing crash. That doesn't help anybody. And that's sort of our, you know, approach. So anyway, I'll give you my 40 years experience on fire, including controlled burns and that type of thing. And we'll hopefully to get the best policy. And incidentally, nationally, it's not any better in the states. I've yet to find the state that really has a handle on it. So I think California has a great opportunity to be a leader. So,
any other questions for Steve? Steve, a couple quick things. First, thank you for the state board adopting the water quality objectives for bacteria. We're relying on that, as probably you're well aware, for the Russian River TMDL. Appreciate that. Quick question. Climate dam removal, draft water quality cert. I looked at the definite plan recently, which is really quite fascinating. Is the draft water quality cert out on your website, Draft Public?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yeah, and all the comments received are on the website, too.
Sounds like some nice light reading. The other thing is WQCC, last on that, is that looking forward to it, putting together a presentation for you up there or for the WQCC, and we'll see you there.
Yeah, looking forward to it myself.
Always good to see you, mister.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Matt St. John,